This is the fourth day of this July 2009 seven-day session. We will resume reading from our text, Zen Essence, translated and edited by Thomas Cleary. We left off yesterday reading from some selections of Zen Master Fen Yang. When you know the mind, mind is Buddha. If you don't know it, it's the devil. Devil and Buddha are products of one mind. Buddha is real, the devil is madness. When we have seen into the nature of the mind, we understand that it is Buddha, it is our own self nature, and that there is nothing outside it. And all of the workings of the mind, even the delusions of the mind themselves are not outside this true nature. When we haven't seen that, when we still see the mind and its defilements as something other, something outside us, then can become assume the quality of a threat or a menace. It is other, and this can bedevil us. And when we reach deeper states of meditation where we can find ourselves in seeming opposition to the mind, something about the mind, our fears, we can concoct threats where there are no threats, problems where there needn't be problems, wouldn't be problems if we could see through, see the empty nature, the insubstantiality of these supposed threats of the mind. It's a common experience for those working on Mu to, at some time or other, to get angry at Mu, work up a kind of a anger at it, which when you consider that Mu is our own mind, it's pretty peculiar that we would get angry at it as though it is something apart from our mind. But it happens. Or feeling trapped by the practice, by Mu, by the mind, feeling it somehow as a force that is opposing us, then this is when it becomes the devil. This is why when we do encounter Makkyo, it is so important to remind ourselves, first of all, to identify it as Makkyo, and then to remind ourselves that it is our own mind. It's nothing out there. There's an old story about a samurai warrior who approached Zen Master Hakuin and said, "What is heaven and what is hell? Or do they really exist?" And Hakuin looked at him with contempt and said, "What, who do you think you are, you chimpanzee? Look at this, look at that sword. Oh yes, look at that sword. Yeah, but you couldn't even cut through a stick of butter with that sword." And the samurai, you know, they were such a proud warrior class and so used to swaggering around and intimidating everyone. And this samurai face flushed and he reached for his sword. And Hakuin said, "That's hell." And then the samurai saw the extraordinary quality of this master he was facing, and he took his hand off the handle of the sword, and he made a deep bow. And Hakuin said, "And that's heaven." To Hakuin and to many of us, it would seem rather amazing that so many people believe that there is some place out there that we could end up in. That's, well, you know, the old images, all the fire licking, all the cartoons from the New Yorker, place of torment, but this was very common among those who consider themselves Buddhists on just a popular level. There are many in Buddhist art. There are many portrayals of all the different kinds of hell: the hot hell, the cold hell, the firing cauldron hell, this and that hell. They have them all articulated and dramatically presented in caves and art. We create our hells and we create our heavens. We are the architects of these states. And we can pass from one to the other and back again in no time, just by our reactions to people and to circumstances. And it all comes out of a sense of separation, of the belief in an other person or thing that is opposing us. Even self-doubt is a state so painful it can be understood in these terms. Linji was asked about Mara. Mara is sort of the Buddhist Satan. Again, for people who in popular Buddhism, he said, "A moment of doubt in your heart is Mara." Fen Yang continues, "Few people believe their inherent mind is Buddha. Most will not take this seriously and therefore are cramped. They are wrapped up in illusions, cravings, resentments, and other afflictions, all because they love the cave of ignorance." They love love the cave of ignorance? Who would love a state of ignorance? Well, anyone who clings to it as something that is less frightening than the unknown. What else, whatever else is out there that we haven't experienced. It is the known. It is, in that sense, it offers one a some appearance of security. This world of dualism, of self and other, and us and them. If we didn't have our understanding of the world framed in terms of these dualisms, where would we be? Where indeed? Aldous Huxley said, "Most ignorance is visible ignorance. We don't know because we don't want to know." Moment by moment, we have a choice between our thoughts and feelings, that is, dwelling in our thoughts and feelings, or in our practice, whatever it is. And we keep getting to make this choice over and over and over again. And those who choose to dwell in thoughts are stuck with their illusions, cravings, resentments, and other afflictions. And yet most people don't see the problem as their own choices, where they choose to put their attention. They are always externalizing it, locating the problem elsewhere. It's someone out there to blame. Something else. And instead of recognizing the obvious, which is that it all is processed through our mind. And that we don't have to cling to our resentments, our cravings, and so forth. What could be more plain? When we are tormenting ourselves with these things, then let go of them. Don't keep chewing on these things. It's masochistic. So much of this practice comes down to a question of where is your faith? In what do you put your faith? In your thoughts? Well, if you're trafficking in your thoughts, well, that's what you believe in. That's what you're choosing. To dwell in your thoughts. Or, on the other hand, is your faith in that which is beyond thought, which we can call mu, the breath. The breath isn't a thought. It's not a thought. Even mu itself is not a thought. It's a word. And when we become absolutely merged with it, then we are free of thoughts. Or any of the questions, the koans, are meant to deliver us from these old tapes that keep playing in our mind, that foster these resentments and fears and so forth. It is so humbling to see what little control we have over the mind. It does seem to have a mind of its own. But little by little, we can get some control of it. We can find the power, and it is power. We can find the strength or the power to know how to direct our attention away from these thoughts that cause us so much unnecessary suffering. And they all really come down to some version of thinking about ourself. It may not be obvious, but somehow it's self-referential, almost all of our thoughts. A Chinese master said, "Why are people so unhappy? Because 99% of what they think about is themselves, and there is none." There is no self apart from a thought of oneself. It's a stunning discovery when we awaken to this. There's no little man in here, no little woman in here. It's just the play of mental formations, as we say in Buddhism. Thought forms, feelings, all the different mental processes that come and go. But we stubbornly believe in some fixed self-entity, some I. And we pay for it. Here's another one. When you are deluded and full of doubt, even 1,000 books of sutras are still not enough. When you have realized understanding, even one word is already too much. I think of after Sesshin, how disagreeable it is to read after Sesshin. I mean, immediately after. Especially something conceptual, very abstract or intellectual. It's so obnoxious to sift through these words. Zen is communicated personally through mental recognition. It is not handed on directly by written words. No empirical evidence to offer, but I get the impression from talking with people at workshops and even our own members that a lot of people substitute reading for the real thing. They become delighted by certain books about Zen, sayings, and even the koans, and they spend their time reading and feeling beguiled by these written things, these experiences that others have had. It's such a shabby substitute for the real thing. When you're settled in Zen, your mind is serene, unaffected by worldly distractions. You enter the realm of enlightenment and transcend the ordinary world, leaving the world while in the midst of society. There's an old phrase that Roshi Kaplow used to use that he would quote from some other master. Wasn't even necessarily a Zen master, to be in the world but not of the world. Again, this is pointing to detachment. We can mix with all kinds of people without getting tangled up in attachments. This is the detachment also of oneness with. The next master is Shwedo, whose Japanese name is Secho. We're now moving up into the 11th century. Shwedo was the what might be called the co-editor, the co-author of the Blue Cliff Record. He first collected all of these dialogues and stories, and then it was Yuan Wu later on, who 60 years later, after Shuido's death, added his own material, and it became the book that we know as the Blue Cliff Record. Someone asked Shuido, "What is the living meaning of Zen?" Shuido said, "The mountains are high, the oceans are wide." Summer is warm, winter is cold. He also said, "The wise boldly pick up a truth as soon as they hear it. Don't wait for a moment or you'll lose your head." Why is it that some people will accept or assimilate teaching more readily than others? It has to be because the teaching is a kind of an echo of their own inherent wisdom. It's a process of recognition. Yes, I knew that. I knew it, but I didn't know it. And there, now, yes, yes. And to assimilate means to act on it, to have it inform your practice, to change your practice accordingly, which basically means to learn how to let go of stuff that comes up. Someone asked Shuido, "What is your manner of teaching?" Shuido replied, "When guests come, one should see them." when thoughts come, notice them. Noticing doesn't mean attending to them. There's a fine distinction, a very important distinction there, to notice them and then return the mind to the practice. This can be difficult if some thoughts tend to be more sticky, or, well, that's not fair, but we tend to stick ourselves to certain thoughts more than others. Certainly things that somehow either confirm our sense of self or challenge or question our sense of self, upset our sense of self. When we notice those thoughts, then we're more tempted to chew on them, to go follow them. So here's the trick: to notice that there are thoughts in the mind while still ignoring the content of the thought. Noticing when there's a thought in the mind, but then ignoring the content. That's a very, very fine line. Noticing but not getting involved with. And that takes real keen attention. It also, what he says, when guests come, one should see them, also, of course, applies to Makyo. This is the stage of Sesshin. It's the fourth day when more people encounter Makyo. The key thing is to recognize them as Makyo, and then don't engage with them. But do recognize that they're Makyo. Once there was a Zen elder who didn't talk to his group at all during Sesshin. One member of the group said, "This way, I've wasted the whole retreat. I don't expect the teacher to explain Buddhism, but it would be nice at least to hear the two words, absolute truth." The elder heard of this and said, "Don't be so quick to complain. There's not even a single word to say about absolute truth." Then when he had said this, he gnashed his teeth and said, "It was pointless to say even that." In the next room was another elder who overheard this and said, "A fine pot of soup befouled by two rat droppings." Every time we talk about Zen or the truth, we are on very dangerous ground. Zen speaks of live words and dead words. Dead words are just explanatory. They're dry, they are not informed with direct experience. Live words is the opposite. Live words, at their best, are presentations of Zen, not explanations of it. They are presenting it, presenting this, it. The This is what distinguishes a teisho at its best from a lecture or even a sermon. But we all can practice at this in our use of speech, not to fall prey to dead words, trying to explain things that one has to experience for herself or himself. Becoming aware and learning here and there that it's becoming increasingly common for Zen teachers, even when working with a student on koans, to explain them. I heard of one student who went to a very, very well-known Zen teacher in Germany, and when he presented his demonstration for the koan, the teacher said, no, this is what it is, and demonstrated for him. It shows so little faith in the student to give them too much. It's really saying, well, you don't really have it in you to get this yourself, so let me give it to you. Whereas, every time the teacher rings his handbell, and as a rejection of an answer that's presented, every time the teacher rings that bell signifying not yet, it's really a vote of confidence in the student. Not yet, but you can do it. No, it's not it, but you can do it. It's all within you. You've got it all. You don't need me to give you anything, spoon feed you anything. The next master is called Huang Long, Rinzai teacher. A little bit in the afterword, a little bit about him. He said Zen practitioners should sit on the site of universal enlightenment right in the midst of all the thorny situations in life and recognize their original face while mixing with the ordinary world. Freedom on earth, he taught, means to be ready for anything. People who are stuck in detachment and cannot enter the realm of passions unscathed can help neither themselves nor others. Now he's warning about those who avoid life, who want to withdraw into their safe cocoon of modulated circumstances, quiet and peace. It can be helpful in early stages of practice, but it's not the sign of a mature practice. The whole point of our practice is not to just cultivate some private, individual peace, but to be able to give, to serve others, to help, to step forward and be useful and helpful to others, to engage, not to withdraw. later he said, all sages since remote antiquity have entered the pit of life and death, gone into the fire of ignorance to help people out. What about you? How do you enter? If people can enter, this can be called not burning in fire, not drowning in water. If people cannot enter, they not only cannot help themselves, they cannot help others. This phrase, that all sages have gone into the fire of ignorance, he's not saying to go help the poor, benighted, ignorant people of the world. He's saying to see deeply into our own delusions, our own ignorance, our own self-deception, to courageously probe into the mind, to look deeply where it is painful to look, where we tend to recoil that which we want to avoid. This is Zazen. This is how we help people out. This is how we free ourselves of the contaminants of egoistic self-centeredness, and so that we can more effectively help other people. Somewhere in the Mumon Khan, Zen Master Mumon says, if you wish to know real gold, see it in the midst of fire. It's apparently it's some test to determine whether something is real gold or something else, is to subject it to fire. Well, Sesshin is fire, isn't it? And we forge in this furnace of Sesshin, we forge the character. No matter what we attain or don't attain, just enduring, holding up through the trials of Sesshin is a process of refining the character, the personality, developing strength that few other endeavors offer. Yes, there is the rigors of severe athletic training. This also does the same. But I wonder how many, I've often wondered this, how many of these great athletes who are such supremely, are so supremely trained, how many would hold up through a seven-day sesshin? Maybe a lot would. I don't know. I really don't know. We know that people who have outer strength that is a compensation for an inner weakness, these people would suffer, would find it very daunting to push on through 7 days of sesshin. Roshi Kappo used to say that in Japanese Zen, and this would be the same same idea in the West, in Japanese Zen, the ideal Zen person is someone who is gentle and flexible, resilient, pliable on the outside, with a core of iron. It's when you have deep inner strength that you have the security, the core security, to be flexible and open and gentle. All right, our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.